Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, November 6th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Klamath Dam removal research shows major improvements. Eureka slated to become a trans sanctuary city. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Over 1 year after the Klamath dams were removed, researchers are seeing massive changes to the flora and fauna from Oregon all the way to Humboldt. Right now, over 20 different groups, including local tribes, government officials, and scientists, are working together to study the changes in the Klamath River after the dams went down, studying the salmon's movements, the river's water temperature, and even implementing AI into their data processing practices. Damon Goodman, the regional director for California Trout, shared his thoughts on the collaboration efforts and the positive impact it is having on the project.
There's different folks in that 21 organizations. Different groups are bringing their expertise to the table where they can, you know, and we're very much working as a team on this. And the expertise or geographic specialization of different organizations kind of, you know, they come to the table with what they can. For example, the Klamath tribes are working above in Oregon and above Klamath Lake. And that makes sense for their geography, you know, their geography to plug in that way. And the Karuk tribe is really engaged with us. Cal Trout member and the Karuk tribe are out today actually netting fish and tagging them. And then the Klamath tribes are up above maintaining the monitoring stations that will detect them as they move upstream. So that's just an example of how this collaboration is working. And it's very much a collaborative process where everybody's bringing what they can to the table to support each other.
Taz Soto, the Karuk tribe's senior research and policy advisor, is spending his time researching on the ground, researching salmon movements, and collecting samples from the fish they are finding. They are using this data to better understand the new migration patterns of the fish and get a better understanding of what the next couple of years will look like.
I think the first step is just learning kind of where the fish go, learning about their distribution throughout the watershed now that there's a lot more habitat. You know, the Klamath just got a lot bigger for salmon. There's over 400 miles of habitat that was previously blocked by the dam. So now fish are distributing it into that habitat. We're found fish already up into Oregon and through Klamath Lake. Klamath tribes are documenting salmon all the way up into the Williamson Sprague River. So salmon are moving much further than they had access to before the dam removal. What we're doing is we're concentrating on doing radio telemetry. So we're putting radio tags in adult salmon as they migrate and tracking where they go, how fast. I think before setting up a long-term monitoring system, you kind of just need to know the basics of where the fish are going and how far, those kind of things. And then you can determine, okay, where are the hotspots for fish production, spawning. This spring, we'll be looking at out-migrating salmon, see how successful these adult salmon that are going up and spawning. So I think we're just taking it one step at a time. You know, as far as the salmon population response, these salmon, their origins aren't from the upper Klamath. The salmon have a 2 to 3 to 4 year, sometimes 5 year life cycle. So all these salmon, their origins are either from the old Iron Gate hatchery or from somewhere downstream of Iron Gate. So these are all new places these fish are going to those fish. And so it'll be interesting to see what kind of production as far as juvenile fish we get from this current cohort of salmon that are exploring these new habitats. So that's a big question. Among a lot of other questions, I mean, I think that one of the things that Karuk Tribe and Yurok and mainly Cal Trout have done is they've installed a sonar camera at the former Iron Gate dam site. And that camera is able to pick up salmon as they swim by and count fish. So that's a really powerful tool in knowing how many fish migrated upstream. We're also working with partners at RES, Resource Environmental Solutions, to determine fish passage and presence absence in reaches above the former dams. So there's a lot of good work happening right now to kind of monitor what the salmon are doing. I mean, I think our general philosophy is let the fish tell us where they're going and what they need. So that's kind of what we're doing right now in the early stages with the telemetry work.
To help keep track of the fish data, Goodman explained the integration of artificial intelligence to help track the amount of fish moving up the stream instead of calculating everything by hand.
One other thing I'll add is that we've been working with a team recently on integrating artificial intelligence into our data processing that has the potential to increase the speed that we are able to process our information. So to generate that estimate of 7,700 Chinook salmon from last fall, we had to review over 2,000 hours of sonar footage, and that was a lot of work. But what we're getting to now is a process where a model is being built by these computer scientists from Caltech and MIT, specifically designed for the Klamath. And what that's going to do is provide us the ability to increase the speed in which we process our information and get that information to the community that is interested in the Klamath and that manages the Klamath. So that should open some doors into the future to improve the way we manage our fish here in the Klamath.
There have been a lot of different factors that have helped change the migration patterns of the salmon, including water quality, temperature, and movement. Soto explained the biggest changes he has seen that have helped with not only the amount of salmon sightings, but also the overall health has vastly improved.
The biggest changes, I mean, there's a lot of changes, and it's hard to just pin one or two changes. There's a lot of change that happened. From the water quality standpoint, we're seeing changes in water quality. When the dams were removed, there were high sediment concentrations moving down the river, a lot of sediment flushing out of the system, and that has improved quite a bit. We're seeing probably one of the biggest changes is just the temperature of the river. We're just in the first 2 years of monitoring since the reservoirs have been gone. We're seeing the river cooling off faster in the kind of late summer, fall period when salmon migrate up the river. So that's been good for the salmon that are migrating up the Klamath. The reservoirs were these large bodies of water that collected heat over the summer and then cooled off slower. So the actual river below Iron Gate Dam wasn't reacting to local air temperatures. You know, when in the late part of the summer, the days begin to get shorter and the nights are longer and the sun sets lower in the horizon, rivers normally cool off. That's true with all the rivers here, but when you have a large reservoir of warm water, it takes longer for that water to cool off. So we saw that right away, and that helps with salmon migration because salmon are swimming into cold water versus migrating up into a river that's warmer. And there's other implications for salmon health. This year, we're seeing salmon that are brighter, seeing less incidence of disease. Fish just seem to be in better condition.
For the Karuk tribe, the process of getting the dams removed has been a long, hard process. But now the dams have been taken down, and they can go back to their roots and be a part of their fishing culture again, Soto explained.
I've worked for the Karuk tribe for a long time, and you know, I know that dam removal was a long process, and it took a lot of energy to do that, and tribal people were committed to helping see that through. And now the reality is that salmon are migrating up the river, migrating past the former dam sites. I would say it gives everyone a lot of hope that when you work really hard at something, you can have success. And, you know, I'm not a Karuk tribal member, but I can say that Karuk people are salmon people. They value salmon highly, and it's part of the lifeblood of their culture. And harvesting salmon, eating salmon is still something that they practice today and take seriously. And, you know, so this is a huge boost to their ability to eat healthy food and practice their fishing culture.
This is not a one-year project. The tribes and officials understand this will be a long process before the full impact can be truly seen. Right now, the salmon are exceeding everyone's expectations, but because of the life cycle of salmon, this is a multi-year project and the data will need to be collected for years to come. A resolution designating Eureka as a trans-sanctuary city is headed for a near-future city council agenda, Daniel Mintz reports.
With the city council responsive to public calls for it, Eureka is slated to become a trans-sanctuary city that will protect access to gender-affirming health care. Requests for the trans-sanctuary designation got a warm response from city council members at their November 4th meeting. During the meeting's open public comment period, several residents lobbied for it. V. Loring credited Eureka for being a safe place to be trans, but a wider context is cause for concern.
I started my life here in Eureka, and when I realized that I needed to restart my life as a woman, even before I knew that was what I was doing, I chose to return to Eureka. This is a place I've always felt safe. Being trans is something that really highlights the vulnerability and connection to others. You depend on medical professionals for the medications that make you feel like you really exist for the first time. You depend on strangers to see you for who you want to be, even when it doesn't yet come naturally to you. I feel incredibly fortunate that Eureka and Eurekans have been nothing but supportive and kind to me. Not everyone is so kind, though, and across the country and even in this state, the federal government has embarked on a project to harm trans people and to punish those who stand up and help us be ourselves. Threats from the Department of Justice have caused multiple gender clinics to close their doors and created a climate of fear around trans healthcare. I believe that this effort, while terrifying, can be stopped. If we stand up together and say we will not be divided, we will not arrest or report members of our community for being trans or providing care, I believe these efforts to drive trans Eurekans into hiding will have no power. This is why I urge the City Council to take up the matter of a trans sanctuary city resolution. It will increase the sense of safety and pride that I feel in my hometown.
Sophia Nix of the Humboldt branch of Democratic Socialists of America said, being trans can be frightening and, quote, one reason why we are afraid is the concern that our medicine and medical procedures will be taken away from us. Nix said a sanctuary designation, quote, would give me and my community one less reason to be afraid. Those who oppose allowing minors to access gender-related treatments, including political leaders of states that have banned it, say it's medically irresponsible, and the most vocal critics equate it to child abuse. But Eureka pediatrician Pippa Coulter said there's evidence supporting its use and it needs protection.
I moved here 2.5 years ago when my former state made it a felony for me to give gender-affirming care or even refer my patients for such care in other states. And so I'm happy to be able to be giving primary care in Eureka full-time, and that includes gender-affirming care for children and teens. What we do is evidence-based. It's recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics and all the professional organizations who are using evidence-based medicine. I would really like to see this resolution passed to help support the providers who are being threatened, you know, at the national level unlawfully with asking people to report us for doing care that's appropriate. And I would like it mostly for the sake of my patients who shouldn't have to be afraid. And they should hear that their community is behind them, that we'll stand up for them and make this a sanctuary city.
During the meeting's future agenda items segment, Councilmember Leslie Castellano recommended taking up a trans sanctuary resolution, which got unanimous agreement. Councilmember Mario Fernandez noted that Trans Remembrance Day, which calls attention to those who've been victims of trans-related hate crimes, is coming up later this month. It will likely take longer to prepare a vote-ready resolution, but council members agreed it should be taken up in the near future. Also headed for a future agenda is allowing the Eureka Police Department to research the cost and uses of an unmanned aerial system or drone program. Councilmember Katie Moulton suggested it and said it wouldn't exactly be something new.
I was taught that if you borrow a tool 3 times, you need to get your own. And EPD has been utilizing the search and communication capabilities of the sheriff office's drone pretty much since it's been available, including the dramatic rescue last week. I know they have because since 2023, they've had to report every single use of things like drones on an annual report to council. These reports are published on the EPD transparency portal. You can find them at eurekaca.gov. Because I have received these reports and revisited all of these reports recently, I would like to discuss allowing EPD to research what a drone for EPD would look like.
The search and rescue operation Moulton referred to happened on October 30th, when a drone was used to track and illuminate someone who had walked into Humboldt Bay in the midst of a mental health crisis. That person was successfully rescued. Authorizing research into acquiring and using a drone system was on the consent agenda of the October 21st meeting, but was taken off it without explanation. But it will return soon, as supported by the council, and would only be the first step that will include what Moulton described as, quote, a robust public process. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Turning to Mendocino, former KMUD contributor and Ukiah High School journalism teacher Matthew Lefevre is facing misdemeanor charges involving alleged inappropriate interactions with minors. Nat Cardo speaks with Mendo local news Elise Cox for the story.
A local high school teacher and journalist is facing a misdemeanor charge involving alleged inappropriate interactions with a minor. Reporter Elise Cox has the story.
Thanks, Matt. So Matt Lefevre is an English and journalism teacher at Ukiah High School. He's also the founder of the independent news site Mendo Fever. And Matt, in the past, he did some reporting for KMUD. He was arrested Monday morning by the Ukiah police. He's charged with knowingly annoying a minor. He was booked into the Mendocino County Jail on $10,000 bail, and he apparently made bail and was released a few hours later. He has not been arraigned, which means he has not been formally charged.
Elise, what do we know about the allegations?
According to police, on October 16th, a parent reported that Lefevre had made an inappropriate sexual comment to her teenage daughter. That same day, the school district placed Lefevre on administrative leave, and they notified the police. As police investigated, another student came forward. This student described inappropriate exchanges with Lefevre over social media.
And police say they found more evidence?
Yes. Investigators obtained a search warrant for Lefevre's phone, computers, and home. They allege he sent the student, quote, scantily clad photos of himself, and that he asked the teen for explicit images in return. Police say the search also turned up evidence of messages to other minors in Mendocino and Sonoma counties. But we don't know who the minors are. The police don't know who the minors are. So it's very hard to know if these anonymous, quote, minors are real minors or even real humans.
What's been the reaction from Ukiah Unified?
Dan Dougherty, the district's communications officer, gave a statement. He said that student safety is the district's first priority, and Lefevre remains on leave pending the outcome of the criminal case.
This case also intersects with Lefevre's work as a journalist, doesn't it?
That's right. In addition to teaching, Lefevre was a North Coast editor for SF Gate and also a recent contributor to the Independent Coast Observer. He's also known for covering police misconduct. And just before his suspension, he was investigating a sexual battery finding against a former Fort Bragg police sergeant. 2 days before being placed on leave, he'd been requesting a copy of a confidential disciplinary memo written by then Chief of Police Neil Cervenka.
Do we know what was in that memo?
Yes. It sustained allegations of sexual battery and unlawful sexual penetration with a foreign object against a sergeant who no longer works for the department. The memo also described unwanted physical contact with an officer's wife and a civilian employee of the police department. It cited dishonesty during the internal investigation. Under California law, such findings are generally subject to public disclosure when they involve sexual assault or dishonesty towards civilians. But they're exempt when they involve sexual battery of one police officer on another. So far, Fort Bragg officials have declined to release a redacted version of the document.
And Lefevre's reporting has touched on other misconduct cases as well?
Yes, he covered a string of high-profile settlements, including a $450,000 payment in a sexual assault case involving a former Ukiah police chief, a $1 million judgment to a woman who said she was raped by a Ukiah sergeant, and a $2.5 million settlement with a former Willits police officer in a harassment suit.
Has Lefevre or his attorney commented?
We reached out by email, but we have not received a response. And meanwhile, Ukiah police are asking anyone with information about inappropriate social media interactions with the username Johnny Ender to contact 707-463-6242.
That's Elise Cox reporting. Thanks, Elise.
Thank you, Nat.
In national news, Democrats sweep first election since Trump's return to office, dealing rebuke to Trump and GOP policies. KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
Democrats made history last night, sweeping elections across the country in what many are calling a rebuke of the Trump administration and Republican policies. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries declared, quote, "Enough with the premature obituaries. The Democratic Party is back," close quote. These were the first major elections since Donald Trump returned to the White House. And Democrats won big, capturing key gubernatorial races and flipping Republican strongholds. In Virginia, Democrat Abigail Spanberger won by more than 15 percentage points, the largest Democratic margin in recent history, becoming Virginia's first woman governor.
We sent a message to the whole world that in 2025, Virginia chose pragmatism over partisanship. We chose our commonwealth over chaos. You all chose leadership that will focus relentlessly on what matters most. Lowering costs, keeping our communities safe, and strengthening our economy for every Virginian.
In New Jersey, Democrat Mikey Sherrill scored a decisive victory, flipping at least five Trump voting counties back to the Democrats.
They always say we're loud, but man, with this vote, you guys just scream from the rooftops. And people around the country have heard you.
But the most watched race of the night was the mayoral race in New York City, where voter turnout topped 1 million, the highest since the late 1960s. Voters elected Zohran Mamdani, the city's first Muslim, South Asian, and Democratic Socialist mayor.
But as Eugene Debs once said, I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity.
Despite Donald Trump making threats to cut funding to New York if Mamdani won the election, in his victory speech, he addressed the president directly.
If anyone can show a nation betrayed by Donald Trump how to defeat him, it is the city that gave rise to him. And if there is any way to terrify a despot, it is by dismantling the very conditions that allowed him to accumulate power. This is not only how we stop Trump, it's how we stop the next one. So, Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up.
The Council on American Islamic Relations called his victory a historic turning point and a, quote, rebuke of Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian politics, close quote. In other races, Hazala Hashimi won Virginia's lieutenant governor seat, becoming the first Muslim American woman elected to a statewide office in U.S. history. In Detroit, Democrat Mary Sheffield made history as the city's first woman mayor, winning by the largest margin ever recorded there. In California, voters approved Proposition 50, a measure Democrats say counters Republican redistricting plans in Texas and other states. The Associated Press called the race almost as soon as the polls closed. Governor Gavin Newsom called the outcome a victory against what he described as Trump's attempt to, quote, rig the midterms by pushing GOP-favored congressional maps.
We organized in an unprecedented way in a 90-day sprint with an unprecedented turnout in a special election with an extraordinary result. We need the state of Virginia. We need the state of Maryland. We need our friends in New York, in Illinois, in Colorado. We need to see other states with the remarkable leaders that have been doing remarkable things meet this moment head on as well to recognize what we're up against in 2026.
Republicans have already announced plans to challenge the result in court. The San Francisco-based Dillon Law Group says it will file a lawsuit. One of their attorneys, Mike Colombo, says Proposition 50 violates the 14th and 15th Amendment.
The map is designed to favor one race of California voters over others. This violates the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection under the law and the right under the 15th Amendment to not have one's vote abridged on account of race. When drawing the Proposition 50 map, the chief consultant who drew the map has stated that the first thing that he did was to increase the power of Latino voters.
Following the blue wave election, President Donald Trump responded.
The shutdown was a big factor, negative for the Republicans. And that was a big factor. And they say that I wasn't on the ballot was the biggest factor.
However, House Speaker Mike Johnson shared a different message to reporters, saying the Republican Party remains on track.
The economy and healthcare are two of the primary issues in the country, clearly. And that's why we are delighted to run on our record. We are addressing that. We are delivering for the people. We are fulfilling our promises.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some tribal leaders are supporting a proposed bill that could expand sports betting in Wisconsin. Chuck Kornbach has more.
About three dozen states allow some form of sports betting, but in Wisconsin, the only legal way to place a wager on a sporting event is at some tribal casinos. Proposed legislation would allow Wisconsin tribes to operate computer servers and other technology so that sports gamblers could be anywhere in the state and place a bet online. Jeff Crawford is Attorney General of the Forest County Potawatomi. He told a legislative hearing that allowing tribes to offer more sports betting would encourage gamblers to turn away from using illegal and unreliable offshore betting firms.
While online gaming is currently at the Wild West in Wisconsin with no regulations or protections for consumers, it does not have to be.
Kyle White Eagle is a tribal legislator for the Ho-Chunk Nation. He says his tribe provides a lot of services across a wide geographic area and needs additional gaming revenue to better tackle problems like poverty and opioid addiction.
Giving tribes in Wisconsin the right to conduct mobile sports betting isn't going to solve these problems completely, but it will help significantly and it will be funding well spent.
But a coalition of national commercial sports gambling firms, including DraftKings and FanDuel, opposes the Wisconsin bill. Attorney Damon Stewart of the Sports Betting Alliance says gamblers would lose out if legally they could only go through the tribes.
Unfortunately, this bill will not result in a competitive market for online sports betting that provides consumers with choice.
If the mobile sports betting bill passes in Wisconsin, it would still take time for the state to renegotiate gaming compacts with the tribes and for the U.S. Interior Department to approve the gaming expansion. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
An Arizona tribe is giving its members some financial relief as the federal government shutdown continues, impacting programs like food assistance. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
The Gila River Indian community is calling them general welfare payments, one-time $1,000 disbursements for each 18-year-old tribal member, regardless of whether they're a SNAP recipient. That decision came on Saturday during a special counsel session called by Governor Stephen Roe Lewis.
I hope that this payment brings some peace of mind during this time of uncertainty at the federal level.
Lewis urges his tribe south of Phoenix to plan for the long haul.
So please, use or set aside for your food needs to pay bills and to add some measure of economic security.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The chairman of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina says he's confident that this year full services and benefits will be extended to his tribe. Chairman John Lowry made the remarks Wednesday during a legislative hearing on the Lumbee Fairness Act, which would grant the tribe federal recognition. Lowry says his tribe has long sought federal status.
I'm a descendant of Solomon Locklear Sr., one of the 44 tribal leaders who in 1888, petitioned Congress to recognize the Lumbee tribe. Today, 137 years later, I stand before you once again advocating for justice and equal treatment through full federal recognition.
Wednesday's hearing in the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs included opposition. Leaders from the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians of North Carolina and the Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma testified against the bill, while Lowry submitted a list of tribal support and testified that nearly all of North Carolina's congressional delegation backs the bill. President Trump, in a statement this week, issued his support for the Lumbee tribe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler. Thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Elise Cox, Nat Cardos, Lauren Schmidt, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.